Good evening. You're tuned to 91.9 FM WDRT Viroqua for a special interview with Paul Cienfuegos. Paul is the founder of Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, which promotes grassroots strategies to exercise democratic power over corporations. His ideas are founded on the notion that the true power in this country lies with the people, and it is up to us to step outside of the systems that prevent us from exercising our power. Paul's worked with many communities throughout the country on developing community rights and will be in Viroqua on May 14th for a workshop. The following interview took place on May 10th with Paul via phone while he was in Decorah, Iowa, for a weekend workshop on community rights with Frac Sand organizers. We began the interview with a discussion on current issues facing the region and how the challenges of activist movements trying to address them are related to corporate rights. There's a lot going on in this area of the country right now as far as social, economic, and environmental concerns. The workers' rights struggles, issues with frac sand mining, and many, many other things. I think it's becoming obvious that the current efforts to stop these things aren't too effective. I mean, protests and petitions just aren't capable of slowing the growing erosion of people's rights here or anywhere else in the current structure. Paul, why do you think this is?
Well, I think the whole system of law that we're in is actually a minority rule system where the system is designed to ensure that the minority gets the kinds of developments they want and the majority gets input and not much else. That's the way the system is designed. So I would say, you know, we don't have a frac sand mining problem. We have a lack of democratic authority problem. We don't have a GMO ag problem. We have a lack of democratic authority problem, and on, so that no matter what the single issue is that these thousands and thousands of groups are working on across the country, like you said, our efforts don't really add up. All of the ecological and social and economic trends are all heading in the wrong direction, and I would argue, and the folks that I work with in the community rights movement would argue, that the reason that that's the case is that we're not focusing on the problem, we're just focusing on symptoms. So GMO agriculture is a symptom of allowing corporations to make governing decisions about how we define agriculture. Frac sand mining isn't the problem, it's the symptom of the problem. The problem is that we allow energy corporations and mining corporations to decide what our energy policy is going to be. And they make these decisions, and they're decisions that are not in the interest of the majority and never have been. And we as activists then respond by going to our county or state or elected officials and pleading with them to try to stop the corporate harm that came out of corporate board of directors' decision-making, rather than saying, you know, why is it even legitimate in this so-called democratic republic to allow corporate boards to be making all of these decisions in the first place? And so for the last 13 years, we've had this very intriguing movement developing that's not left or right wing. It's kind of just citizens recognizing their inherent authority of self-government at the local level and saying, you know, for whatever reason, people are waking up and saying government is not serving us. And so we need to understand that we can actually say no to these things and instead take our own self-governing authority and define the kind of communities we want to live in. So it's not just no to frac sand mining or no to GMO ag. It's what kind of energy policy do we want? What kind of agricultural policy do we want by majority? What do we, the people, want? And unfortunately, because of the nature of the utter lack of real democratic process in this country, really from the start, people are used to being outside of the decision-making process. And so we tend to be focused on kind of an emergency response to the latest corporate proposed crisis that is coming into our communities, or we're focused on, you know, what crumbs can we get. So, for example, I would say, you know, that the 1.5 or 2 year moratoriums on frac sand mining that a lot of communities are organizing for, and that I understand that Allamaquee County has just won an 18-month moratorium a few months ago in northeast Iowa near where I am now, that all of these are absolutely terrific wins, but they're very temporary, and that in that open space that we have to figure out what to do, the question should not be simply what do we want to stop or what can we get, but what do we want? And I think when people learn about, you know, all of these corporate problems, what they want is to say no. And we're used to being told that the public can't say no and that even our elected officials can't say no, for example, to frac sand mining. But what's exciting is I'm part of a movement where 150 communities in 8 states are figuring out how to say locally enforceable, legally binding, no, we don't want this, and what we do want is something else, and here's what it is, and we're going to make that law, that into enforceable law. So it's a very exciting, paradigm-shifting community rights movement.
So essentially you're saying that the issues many activist organizations are fighting against actually aren't problems themselves, but they're rather symptoms of corporate rights.
Exactly.
So what are corporate rights and how did they come to be?
For about 195 years, ever since 1819, that's 1819, the U.S. Supreme Court has been granting one constitutional right for corporations after another. Literally, hundreds and hundreds of U.S. Supreme Court decisions have given corporations rights. They've granted them all sorts of free speech rights, First Amendment rights. Free speech for corporations is not just defined as the right for a corporation to have a political voice and a commercial voice, but that translates into that we can't limit how much money a corporation can donate to influence an election, because that would violate its right to speak to us. Money equals speech, a 1976 decision. We can't have the kind of control we assume we could have through our government bodies over the labeling of products, country of origin laws, ingredients, warnings, etc., because that would violate a corporation's freedom of mind or right to not speak. So that's like a little bit of First Amendment free speech right. Corporations have won dozens of property rights wins in the U.S. Supreme Court. And the big juicy stuff for corporate rights around property is intangible property rights or intellectual property. So they've won all sorts of capacity to have uninterfered with decision-making authority over what they produce and how they produce it and how work is organized, how their profits are invested. So we take this all for granted that corporations are these Goliaths and we have to bat at them, you know, one corporate crisis at a time, when in fact all of these issues come down to corporations have all of this power because they have First Amendment rights, property rights, contract rights, commerce clause rights, search and seizure rights, privacy rights, as if they were human beings under law. And as long as our activism doesn't understand where their actual power comes from, we're left to battle one corporate arm at a time endlessly into the future, and we can see where that kind of activism leads us.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think community rights fit into this, and how do they address the problem of corporate rights?
So for the past 13 years, beginning in rural conservative farm communities in Pennsylvania, groups have started to pass legally binding, locally enforceable law that is rights-based law. It's a whole new paradigm of local lawmaking that strips the particular industrial sector of corporate rights that are being banned. So, for example, it started in Wells Township, Pennsylvania, 13 years ago, a small conservative farm township of hog farmers, family hog farmers. And for years, they had been trying to figure out how to stop factory farms, 15,000-head hog factory farms from coming into their community, Wells Township initially. And what they figured out after years and years of working through the regulatory process, pleading with the regulatory agencies in Pennsylvania to stop these things, and they got it delayed for a few years, but it was really clear that ultimately the regulators don't ever say no. Regulatory agencies are about allowing corporate activity and then regulating the harms around the edges. And they got involved with a public interest law firm in Pennsylvania called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Its acronym is its website, CELDF.org. And that group started to help them understand that there was a more powerful way to do this and that they could actually pass local laws that they could directly enforce that banned corporate agriculture entirely within their township. And this idea started catching on like wildfire. And within a few years, 20 conservative rural farm communities in Pennsylvania had passed bans on corporations engaging in farming or owning farmland. And then fast forward a couple of years, other rural communities in Pennsylvania that were the recipients of endless amounts of sewage sludge from cities, which is pretty toxic stuff, that had been dumped on farmland as a way to get rid of it, they banned, 80 rural communities in Pennsylvania banned the sewage sludge dumping by corporations on farmland. And then communities in Maine got involved, and they used the same paradigm-shifting model of law to ban water withdrawal by corporations to put in little plastic bottles and sell to us. And the movement has just continued to grow. And in the last few years, for the first time, a major city has gotten involved, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by a unanimous vote of the city council, passed an ordinance about 3 years ago that's a right to water ordinance. Increasingly, the ordinances are being framed as the right to rather than just a ban. So fracking was becoming an urgent issue within the city of Pittsburgh, and the city council, by unanimous vote, passed a rights-based ordinance that protects the water by banning all fracking within the city. And even though they were threatened by the natural gas industry, they passed it anyway, unanimously. So Pittsburgh is now the first major city in the community rights movement. And increasingly what's happening is communities are rather than trying to stop one corporate harm, one corporate crisis at a time, they're passing legally enforceable rights-based law that defines what they want rather than just trying to stop one corporate harm at a time. So, for example, four communities in New Hampshire in the last year and a half have passed ordinances that give the community the right of a sustainable energy future. If you can imagine that, putting that into enforceable local law. And the way they do it is, within the body of the law, they define unsustainable energy, and then they say, within the body of the law, any energy which meets the definition of unsustainable energy is now prohibited in our town. And that has passed through the annual town meeting vote. In two of four towns, it literally passed unanimously, hundreds of people to zero, small New Hampshire communities. They were working to stop a Hydro-Quebec transmission line, these four communities. In Oregon, I'm working very closely with a couple of counties that are hoping to pass through the ballot box next May a couple ballot initiatives that define unsustainable agriculture and prohibit anything that meets that definition countywide. So GMO agriculture will be entirely banned in two counties next May if these things pass in the ballot box. So this is a whole new paradigm of lawmaking, and kind of the last missing piece of my description is that within the body of the law, they directly challenge the right of corporations. So each of these ordinances strips corporations of all of their constitutional rights within the ordinance language itself.
Where does state and federal law fit into all this?
Well, what's so interesting, and of course that is the $64,000 question, is that these laws are direct challenges to state and federal law, and they're direct challenges to corporate rights, obviously. There's something called state preemption, which is something that's law in every state in the union, that says that anything that a state government considers legal and normal, a local government cannot ban. So, for example, factory farming in Pennsylvania is considered a legal and normal corporate activity, so the local community can't ban it. So when these ordinances are passed that do just that, they ban it, they come up against state preemption law, and they do that very purposefully. And what they're trying to do is create what's called a crisis of jurisdiction, where one scale of government is challenging the authority of another scale of government. And the most obvious description of this is the medical marijuana movement in the United States, where in a couple dozen states, through the ballot box, the voters have passed the right to medical marijuana, even though the federal government claims federal preemption. In other words, they're saying the states don't have any legal authority to make marijuana legal. And so you create a crisis of jurisdiction where the state and the feds start battling it out for legal authority. And although the feds still haven't surrendered on this one, it's very clear to anyone who pays attention to the medical marijuana movement that those 15 or 20 states have really already won the battle, that millions and millions of Americans are now smoking marijuana completely legally with doctors, you know, with a doctor's authority slip. So that's a crisis of jurisdiction, is it forces a legal battle into a new kind of arena where we can out-mobilize and out-organize a higher scale of government. So that's what these local communities are doing. 150 communities in eight states have purposefully created crisis of jurisdiction situations where they're forcing the state government to challenge their rights of local self-government. And if you look back in American history, that's what the abolitionists and the suffragists did. is they forced new rights into law by breaking the law. That's one of the most powerful ways that citizens have always done it. You know, we have a long history of civil disobedience to challenge unjust laws. Some of us in the movement call what we're doing collective acts of municipal civil disobedience, where the local lawmaking is the civil disobedience.
So is the passing of these ordinances part of a larger strategy?
Yes. So what I've described so far is the first phase of a three-phase strategy. So 150 communities in 8 states have done this so far. The goal is thousands and thousands of communities doing this, hopefully within the next half a dozen years. The second phase, which has already begun in our movement, is once a state has a sufficient number of communities that have already passed these rights-based laws, those communities start organizing to push rights up into state law. So state laws and state constitutions forbid local communities of having any significant self-governing authority. And there's some very interesting historical reasons why that are very purposeful. It's an anti-democracy aspect to the way our country is organized. And so if you're going to start doing this, you have to tackle state law and state constitutions. So that second phase is we're pushing our rights up into the state level, calling constitutional conventions and rewriting state law and state constitutions so that they guarantee that a local community has the authority to govern itself. And I think, you know, I would argue, and I think listeners would probably agree, that if a community by majority does not have the authority to govern itself, then we can't even claim we live in a democratic society. I don't think that we do, because we don't have that authority under conventional law. So that's the second phase. And then the third phase, once states have done this, once we've rewritten state constitutional law so that it actually starts privileging the right of the people over corporations and private property, then we do the same thing pushing up to the final level, which is that we retake our federal constitution, which if you just read the constitution is pretty much a document that guarantees the rights for property and commerce. There's nothing really in it about people until you get to the amendments that were added years later. So the second phase of local communities pushing rights up to the state, that process has already begun in 4 states, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, and Washington State. And I'm here in the Midwest doing a workshop tour in a number of small communities across the Midwest to start to bring this movement here.
And based on your experiences so far, what do you think the major challenges will be towards achieving that?
Well, I think you might be surprised by my answer. I think the primary challenge is that people feel powerless and hopeless, and that feeling is disguised as political pessimism or, you know, we'll never get away with it, so we're not even going to try. But I don't think that's political analysis. I think that's a deep-rooted sense in the country that we, the people, are so bashed down the society is really based on a model, I would say by design, that excludes the majority from any meaningful participation in the democratic process. And people tend to think, what you hear is, oh, the industry has captured the regulatory agency, or we have to get our Congress people and senators to start paying attention to us again as the majority. But the reality is that the majority has never had any real control in this country. On paper, we're a majority-rule society, but in reality, a small elite has always ruled right from the beginning. I mean, Madison, the primary drafter of the U.S. Constitution, has this amazing quote. He says, the primary role of government is to protect the opulent minority from the majority. I mean, who's the guy who mostly wrote the U.S. Constitution? And he was very effective. He wrote a document of the highest law of the land, the Constitution, that pretty much privileges the minority's rights and the rights of property over all of the rest of us. We were just a rabble. We were designed to be excluded from the process. So I think what comes out of that energetically and culturally is a sense of profound hopelessness and powerlessness. So when I come to a new community and I share this very interesting information, what I mostly get back is people saying, oh, it's so much work, oh, it would never succeed. And I think that's our learned powerlessness. I don't think that's an analysis. I think it's just, you know, a deep, you know, grieving that all of us are feeling about our world.
How do we move past that, both as individuals and as communities?
My direct experience is that people who come through, you know, my initial introductory evening workshop, which I'll be leading in Viroqua this Tuesday evening, or my weekend-long workshop, you know, normally out of a workshop of 25 or 30 people, 5 or 10 folks come out of it going, this is exciting. I want to do something about this. And they launch a community rights group. And it may take 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years, depending on how democratic or anti-democratic is the state's laws. That's very important in the process. How long it may take to actually be able to get to the point that you're passing a community rights ordinance. These are not easy things to pass. But what's interesting is in almost every community where a group does start and has the stamina to do a couple of years' work, the thing ultimately passes, either through the elected officials passing it or through a ballot initiative at the local level, if you're in one of the 30 states in the country where people can vote directly.
How do partisan politics pose a challenge to a movement like this being successful?
I think that the propaganda system is so thick in this country that liberals and progressives and greens mock and make fun of Republicans, and the right wing makes fun of the left. And that's part of the divide and conquer strategy that has worked so incredibly well to keep people apart and not realizing that we share enormous numbers of values across the political spectrum. So again, I would say it's the propaganda system that's, you know, that has created the divide and conquer. That's the main problem. The workshops I lead are quite non-ideological. It's conservatives who mostly get this stuff so far around the United States. Liberals and progressives continue to somehow count on state and federal regulatory law to protect us. And I think the record is just increasingly clear that that system is working for the corporations rather than for us. But yes, the work is very non-ideological. People from any political perspective who are concerned about the rise of corporate power and want to see more authentic democratic participation at the local level would find this work really interesting.
How would a movement like the one you're describing interact with other types of movements, say with Transition Town?
I think that they're natural allies, and I've been trying to get the attention of the Transition Town movement now pretty actively for about 3 years. If you go to my website at paulcnfuegos.com, you can read an essay, you can read text of a speech I gave to the Portland, Oregon Transition Group last year that basically says, imagine if your vision for an energy dissent action plan or for sustainable transportation or manufacturing or house building, to that authentic, active, citywide or townwide sustainability vision the Transition is so good at putting forth, you have to tackle the problem that right now, we the people defining a sustainable future for ourselves is unconstitutional, believe it or not. Us to get to real sustainability currently violates corporate constitutional rights and violates state preemption laws. So unless we actually push a rights-based strategy back against those unjust, illegitimate laws, we're not actually going to ever create authentically sustainable culture in the United States. And so far, I've had absolutely nobody in the transition movement responding in a way that shows some excitement or some interest. I continue to be convinced that there's got to be a Transition Town group out there that wants to do more than just neighborhood-level organizing. In no way do I want to put down what Transition is already accomplishing, but we can't get to a truly sustainable society simply by networking with our neighbors and building community gardens and food gardens and schools. To get there, we have to make policy. And making policy requires that citizens start pushing back against all these unjust legal structures and saying, we have to change the legal structures so that we, the people, have the authority to design and define the sustainable future that we want under law. So yes, I think there's a tremendous conversation that needs to happen between the two movements, and my website has kind of an introduction to this for a transition audience, but I haven't yet found the group that understands that and wants to move forward.
Do you know of any other countries that have done things like this already, incorporating community rights or natural rights into their constitutions?
The natural rights piece, there has been dramatic developments just in the last handful of years. What I failed to mention is that a number of these rural conservative communities in Pennsylvania incorporated into their local ordinances a guarantee, a protection of rights for nature. Local communities started to understand that it gives them more legal power if nature has rights rather than just being property that you can destroy because you own the property. And what's so fascinating to me is that the nation of Ecuador, which a handful of years ago was writing a brand new constitution for itself, somehow their parliament found out what was happening in rural Pennsylvania, and they invited folks from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and some of the rural farm folks to come to Ecuador and to teach them about rights of nature under law. And now Ecuador is the first country in the world that's put in its brand new constitution a guarantee for Pachamama, or the living earth, so that nature actually has legally enforceable rights. And it's even already been tested once in the Ecuadorian Supreme Court, where a river was harmed by a provincial government, and people came to the Supreme Court representing the rights of the river, and the river actually won the legal case in the Ecuadorian Supreme Court a couple of years ago. The Yolcabamba River, I believe, was the name of the river. And now restoration is happening on order of the Ecuadorian Supreme Court because the provincial government violated the rights of the river in its construction project. So in Nepal, in Italy, in Bolivia, rights of nature laws are moving forward. There's an actual international network of communities working on rights of nature under law. And amazingly enough, it started in conservative rural Pennsylvania communities. The community rights piece, I'm not aware of local grassroots community majority lawmaking happening in other countries.
Very interesting. Paul, we're running out of time here, but you are going to be in Viroqua on Tuesday, May 14th for a workshop. What are you going to be covering?
I'm going to be focusing on Oregon's Food Bill of Rights in my evening workshop to help people understand how you could pass laws in your community or in your county that legislates the legal requirement for sustainable agriculture.
Very good. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with community organizer Paul Cienfuegos. Paul will be in Viroqua on Tuesday, May 14th at the Rooted Spoon for a workshop on developing a food bill of rights. More information about Paul's work can be found on his website at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for tuning in. Have a good night.